I'll be calling the Senate Committee on Commerce to order now, and I got one piece of business I need to take care of before we get into our schedule for today. Today is going to be our last day to have Karen Scopel, who is our committee assistant, working for us because she will be completing her work for the committee as of tomorrow. So, first, Karen, thank you very much, and we really appreciate everything you've done. And let's see, with that said, what I'm going to do is we have a number of items that we're going to be working today, including moving multiple bills. What I want to do is, because I've got one committee member who's in another committee that we need to have here before we start doing some of our work sessions, I'm going to go ahead and start with a public hearing on House Bill 2662. Representative Hovey.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2662A allows victims of domestic violence to keep unemployment insurance if they left work to protect themselves or their minor children.
And can you give us history as to its track through the House?
It passed the House Judiciary Committee 9-0, and the floor vote at the House was 58 ayes.
All right. Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Holby. I'm State Representative for House District 8. House Bill 2662A is, as you know, has met with a lot of support, as your administrator noted, if the votes cast. This bill really is just about clarifying some language and in the statutes regarding unemployment insurance and the availability of those benefits to victims of domestic violence. The bill also expands it to victims of sexual assault, stalking, and the minor children if they're in danger. I've provided you with written testimony, and I'm not going to read it to you because I know you're capable of doing that yourself if you have time. But I will hit on a few points. House Bill 2662A is really just about providing people that are in really grave situations the opportunity to get out. Currently, the statute requires victims of domestic violence to pursue all reasonable alternatives and protecting themselves at work. And as we all know, that domestic violence doesn't always happen at the workplace, and oftentimes victims don't have an opportunity or time to really pursue all reasonable alternatives. And it's appeals boards and judges have been denying claims to these folks when they have left the area to protect themselves and then quit their jobs and try to collect unemployment insurance benefits because they haven't pursued all the reasonable alternatives. For instance, sometimes they have to have restraining orders, reports to the police, hospital records, and work with their employers to actually, you know, pursue every reasonable alternative, and frankly, sometimes they just don't have time to do that. They just need to get out. So this bill is really just aimed at protecting those victims. It has a minimal impact to the trust funds, expected to be under $200,000. It does not really affect the employer's tax rate. These claims are not counted against the employer's service rate history in terms of determining what their unemployment tax rate will be. So this bill is really a great opportunity for the state to provide some protection for folks that really need it, and I urge you to pass this bill. We've had several instances, as the chair probably remembers, Ms. Benitez, who was killed a couple of years ago because of her ex-husband stalking her, and she did everything right, pursuing all reasonable alternatives, but the only thing she didn't do was leave. And under current statute, she probably wouldn't have qualified for unemployment benefits. And sometimes it's that little bit of financial help that enables them to economically get out of town. So I really urge you to support this bill, pass it on to the Senate, and with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just one quick question. Chair Pruszynski, Representative Hulvey, on average, at any point in time, how many employees would be affected by this proposed legislation?
On an average, at any point in time?
Yeah, I mean, just...
You know, there's someone from the employment department. It's expect here. I'm not sure I'm the expert on that, but they really don't expect maybe 25 cases per year under this legislation.
That's what I need to know.
Yeah.
Very small.
It's pretty small, and you know, it's not really going to add any more workload to the employment division. They hear these cases, they just end up being denied. So it's not really adding any workload to them. It's just, you know, going to have a different outcome, hopefully, for these victims.
Thank you. Yeah.
And for the record, it looks like on the fiscal analysis, it does actually make a statement that a very small number, fewer than 25 per year, of individuals may actually qualify under the new provisions. Mm. And I assume that was the information that you had at the time that the bill came through the House and was presented on the floor.
Correct.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And if there's, I'm going to ask if there's anyone else here that needs to give testimony on House Bill 2662. If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And what I want to do is get another senator in here and go ahead and do a work session. And also, Ringles and B. Let's see if we can't get them pulled. So we'll stand at ease for a moment, Karen. I am still, as you can see, missing a senator or two. So because of that, we're going ahead and start a continuation of a public hearing that we started last week on Senate Bill 446. But I am going to tell everyone, I know that two of my senators' members have other commitments, so we will probably be breaking up the public hearing to go ahead and take care of the work session material that we need to take care of. So with that, I have... Mr. Miller, I'm going to let you come up first.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm an assistant staff counsel for the Office of the State Court Administrator. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. Specifically, I'm here today to comment on the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 446. We're not here to take a position on the legislative policy of tort reform, but we do have some serious concerns with the -4 amendments because of the fairly extensive impact they'll have on court administration and court operations. We've not finished our analysis of the amendments. They contain an awful lot of things that would need to be accomplished by the courts, and we're still waiting for comment from various judges and as our various portions of the department look at it to determine what the impact would be. We have identified some general areas that the state court administrator has set out in a letter that we've just distributed to you. We have a couple of constitutional concerns with the amendment as drafted. We have some concern that, especially regarding the assessment of surcharges by the Chief Justice, that there may be concerns on separation of powers or delegation of powers problems. There is also a provision in the amendment to have the pre-litigation panel hearings closed to the public, which we think may cause a problem with Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, which requires that we have open courts. And the same problem arises with the sealed records as well. As you know, by and large, our court files are open to the public to view at any time that we're open for business. There are several other problems for the courts as far as running these panels. In general, the things come to the court by way of a lawsuit. Things are filed with the court and it becomes a lawsuit. This amendment sets up something that isn't quite a lawsuit, so it's a little difficult to fit into how we normally work things. And because of that, it makes it a little difficult for us to decide how to handle those things, because we have a very set procedure for lawsuits, and with this there isn't a lot of definition as to what happened with it. Some of the specific issues that we see, and I'll start with the source and master lists.
Yeah. Mr. Miller, I think what you've given us is enough as to what your concerns are. I don't think we need to go in great detail at this time in specifics, and if we should at some point want to move the dash fours, when we need more information, we'll get it from you. I'm going to go ahead and ask if anyone has any questions now based on the testimony we've heard. I guess I'm not knowing what else I have in the way of people to give testimony today. I want to just, I guess, register the concerns the courts have with the dash fours. And if we have a need to have more detailed information, we'll let you know if that's all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. No questions? I'm going to go ahead and recess the public hearing we have on 446. I'm going to open up a work session on 2662A. And Senator Burdick, could you make a motion for us on 2662A?
Do we have an amendment?
There is not.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2662 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2662A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2662, and I will open a...
Do you want to carry
it? I'll carry that one. And I will open a work session on Senate Bill 968. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 968 is the refund anticipation loan bill. It was passed out of committee on April 28th. It came back for reconsideration. Since then, we have changed it slightly. The notice provisions have been rewritten to be consistent with the House bill that just passed today, House Bill 2995. It authorizes the Board of Accountancy and the State Board of Tax Preparers to take disciplinary actions if a facilitator of loans violates the disclosure requirements. We took out the Attorney General the unlawful trade practice private right of action, but we kept the Attorney General private right of action. That we still have the preemption for local government. This has minimal or no fiscal impact and no revenue impact. And today we got the dash sevens, and the dash sevens are the same as the dash six, except they take out the recording requirements for the Board of Tax Preparers, practitioners, and the Board of Accountancy. And that we did that because the small agents, they're very small agencies, and there would be a fiscal if we put those in. So there was tracking requirements on page 12 and section 8 and page 13, section 9 on the dash sixes. Those have been deleted on the dash seven.
All right. And it's my understanding part of this was an attempt to address some of the concerns that had been raised about the private right of action, and that we did want to maintain some course of action through the Department of Justice.
Right. So now there's no private right of action, but there is an Attorney General enforcement.
All right. Thank you. And is there any questions regarding the dash sevens?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a comment. I oppose the limitations on what local governments can impose. I think the preemption laws are generally bad. I understand why people want them, but I think it makes it more difficult to advance consumer protection just across the board, and that troubles me about this bill.
All right, I appreciate your concern. I guess what I'm going to need to ask is, because we'd like to move the bill today, if you're willing to move it. The reason that we put the preemption in is for the simple fact that the chair's position is that if we have every city potentially having their own set of rules, you basically can make the ability for the organizations to do the business on a statewide basis very costly. And I think that it would actually hinder the ability for people who may want to access these services to have those services.
I think that, Mr. Chair, just to respond, I think there needs to be tighter restrictions for these services than are set forth in this bill. One example of how preemption is operated on the smoking in bars and restaurants is that it's very difficult for our state to move forward on that issue because of the power of the tobacco lobby in this building. We grandfathered some communities in that have good laws in that area, but I think that in general it's going to be very hard to make progress on that issue because of the preemption law, and that's my concern in this case as well.
All right. Mr. Chair, if I could just ask a question, because that's also very skeptical of preemption, but I'm just wondering how many local areas actually do regulate these. Maybe council knows.
There are none. So.
Yeah, my understanding, there's no one that's at the local level that is currently doing any regulations of this business. Mm-hmm. What we're attempting to do is put some type of reasonable regulations and a giving the ability for those organizations, those within the industry, to be able to actually have a more of a seamless process that can be used throughout the state and not be subject to individual rules and regulations for each of the cities. And the bottom line is, the either we move the bill or it's more than likely we'll be dead.
Mr. Chair, it would be my preference to have a discussion with you. I mean, I unfortunately haven't been involved in the dynamics of this. I don't understand some of the trade-offs made, and so I'm somewhat at a disadvantage in that regard. I haven't read these new amendments. I haven't seen them till just now. My preference would be to look at this on Tuesday, and I know that may inconvenience some, but to have a further conversation with you about them.
Yeah. I'll put it as frank as I can. We have one more meeting. It's not Tuesday. It's next Thursday.
Thursday, okay.
And so I'm willing to hold this over for that purpose.
Okay.
But, our schedules need to get together because...
I understand.
There are people who would like to have this bill move forward and get over to the House, and I'm going to attempt to meet that commitment that I've given to the proponents of the bill, including one of the representatives that you've been working with on other issues.
Okay. I don't know who you mean. Okay.
You don't know soon enough. She'll be calling you. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 968, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 426. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 426 is the union card check bill that requires public employers to recognize the majority of employees of a labor organization if they present the employer with signed authorization cards. There's a Dash 1 amendment which clarifies that unrepresented employees will not be covered under this amendment and applies when no labor organization has been recognized or certifies that exclusive representation of a group of employees. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You're more than welcome. Thank you for the great presentation. So at this point, we need to move the Dash 1s.
Yes.
Senator Burdick, would you be so kind to make the motion on the Dash 1 for Senate Bill 426?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 426.
Senator Burdick moves the Dash 1s for Senate Bill 426. Is there any discussion? Any objection? It seems like Senator Wissett would like to be noted as objecting to it. Any other objection? If not, it passes to the floor, Senate Bill 426, and we'll go.
Is that an amendment or a...
Oh, excuse me, the Dash 1s. Excuse me. We have incorporated the Dash 1s into 426. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 426 is amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 426 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I am moving this bill and voting it out of committee in deference to my friends, in deference and great appreciation to my friends who are supporting this bill. I have serious concerns that the bill will do what they want it to do, and what I think a lot of us would want it to do, and I'm struggling with that, and I'm still keeping my mind open, but it could well be that it still will not have my support on the floor, but I'm happy to move it out of committee.
Thank you for your comments and your willingness to give the courtesy vote for 426. I will put on the record that I did ask the proponents as to whether this process is actually being used in other states. The information I received
just before our hearing today, is that there are four states that currently are using it. New York State, they've been using it since 1999. Three additional states are California, Illinois, and New Mexico. And hopefully the proponents will come by and sit down and discuss those issues with you that you have and such. Senator Wissett.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think two things. One, that would mean that 46 states are not using it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to make a couple of comments regarding just quotes from Diane Rosenbaum's testimony on this way back when. Workers are essentially forced into two votes of whether or not they want to form a union. The process of an election is just a chance to interfere in the free choice of workers. Current law forces workers to go through a difficult process to exercise their freedom called election. I don't see the point in this bill. I think that it's what it does is it prevents the union people from having a free election, clearly, and I will oppose it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments?
Well, I have two emails in my file. One says I'm a constituent of yours, and they want me to support the bill. They're from Eugene. The other one says I'm a constituent of yours. They want me to support the bill. They're from Cove, Oregon, which is in eastern Oregon. But
well, you got a pretty big district.
I have a very large district. So I feel compelled to support them.
Senator Ringo thinks he's in the U.S. Senate, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Or his constituents do, anyway.
Yeah. All right. And if there's not any other discussion, any objections besides Senator Wissett? That will be the only one. So Senate Bill 426, as amended, moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation. And I'll close the work session on 426. And can I get one more? I'm going to open up the carrier will be the good Senator Ringo representing all of his constituents throughout the state. And we'll go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1057.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1057 is the ID theft bill. Today we're looking at the Dash 6 amendments. The Dash 6 amendments made changes to the bill to make it consistent with other states that change the definition of personal information to require Social Security numbers and protection. This Social Security number protection in conjunction with names. It rewrote the trigger of the notice of breach to be a reasonable belief of unauthorized use. Would you like me to go through all of these, or would you? Do you want them for the record, or do you want to hurry?
I think we probably need to hurry, knowing the good senator's schedule for conference room B. Unless
so the Dash 6 amendments are a result of talking to state agencies and getting their concerns addressed, and also looking at other states and trying to make this bill more consistent with other states.
All right. Any discussions regarding the amendments for 1057, the Dash 6 amendment? Senator Burdick, would you be so kind?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 6 amendment to Senate Bill 1057.
Senator Burdick moves the Dash 6 amendments for 1057. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1057 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 1057 as amended with the Dash 6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I'll carry that one. And thank you, Senator Ringo. And I think if you want to check back with us later, I think we've got pretty much everything needed to be dealt with on the work session. I'm going to go ahead and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 446, and I'm going to ask Jane Myers to please come forward. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association. The association is supportive of efforts to lower the cost of liability insurance. And as I understand it, the Dash 4 amendment to the bill is very much like or is the same as Senate Bill 1029. And we did support that bill and do support that bill, so we will support the Dash 4 amendments. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Okay. Senator Wissett, do you have any questions regarding the Dash 4s or the testimony Ms. Myers has given?
I don't think so. At this point, I assume you were in the room when Mr. Miller gave his testimony on the part of the Judicial Department. So we'll be taking those things in consideration at the same time. Thank you for coming up and giving your testimony. At this point, I'm going to go ahead and ask Richard Lane and Mark Bocci. And then I've got Dr. Tom Sonoris, I believe.
Sonoris.
And I'm Dr. Sonoris, if you'd like.
Sidoris.
Oh, Sidoris, excuse me.
Sidoris.
And Dr. Sidoris, I don't know if you'd like to come up with this panel. You're more than welcome to do so. Yes. And I'll let you start with whatever order you want. Just please identify yourself before you give your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Richard Lane. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers to speak to you about Senate Bill 446, and I'm briefly going to try to cross over the various permutations of the dashes that we have now in front of us. To my immediate right is Dr. Tom Sidoris, and further down to my right is Mr. Mark Bocci. I'm going to try to be as brief as possible, but there are a number of things that I think the committee needs to be aware of. I'm going to try to not cover ground that may have been covered on the hearings last Thursday. I apologize in advance if some of it is duplicative of what you may have heard already. Senate Bill 446, as originally drafted, looks like it intends to amend certain provisions of the medical liability insurance requirements and establish some sort of a pre-screening panel. As the committee may be aware, the physicians in the state of Oregon have experienced an increase in their premium rates, but as you look at, and I assume you have written material now in front of you that we have submitted, I am not going to go in great detail what's in the written materials. I think the committee can take a look at that at their leisure, but I am going to track the written materials. The written materials indicate, as the United States General Accounting Office, various industry, the American Medical Association itself has documented the rise that we have seen in this state and across the nation in premium liability costs, the direct results of the stock market, and a predictable, often seen, regular, soft, hard insurance cycle that causes insurance rates to decrease artificially and then increase when the market drops out of the bottom. The American Medical Association Board of Trustees recognized the link between rising premium costs and insurance underwriting cycles in a report to its House of Delegates, noting, for several years, insurers kept prices artificially low while competing for market share and new revenue to invest in a booming stock market. As the bull market surged, investments by these historically conservative insurers rose to 10.6% in 1999, up from a more typical 3% in 1992. With the market now in a slump, the insurers can no longer use investment gains to stabilize low rates. The impact increased premium costs. I have the Weiss Ratings, Inc., a reputable industry source, often cited, discussing the recent soft market lasted approximately 12 years, from 1987 to 1999, because of the raging bull market in stocks. Insurers made so much money in their investments that they were aggressively underpricing their policies and were prepared to deliberately lose money in their underwriting and still turn a profit overall. As a result, losses in the core operation more than offset the surging gains from the stock market boom and were largely overlooked by industry and regulators alike. The problem that Oregon is experiencing is a problem that's being experienced nationwide. It has nothing to do with tort reform. It has nothing to do with liability costs. And it will probably, as we'll point out in some of the profits that are now being reported, be on the tail end and entering another swing soft market cycle. The States that have enacted tort reform or caps were discussed briefly by some of the proponents of 446 last week. Indicate that caps without states without caps. The medium annual premium increase at a slower clip, 35.9%, than states with caps that saw an annual premium increase of 48.2% increase.
Yeah. If I could interrupt for a minute, those it's interesting statistics, but could you give us absolute cost there? I mean, the dollar difference?
Senator Wichert, Chair Pozanski, no, but I would absolutely make a note, and I think I could probably get an answer to you. I just don't have sort of all the resources at my fingertips here right now.
Thank you. I would like to see that.
A recent filing in the state of Texas, which is a cap state, by GE Medical Protective, a regulatory filing that I do have in my office in 2004 requesting an increase in rates despite a cap state, indicated that the non-economic damage cap would be responsible for no more than a 1% drop in losses, and a mandatory periodic payment statute also enacted would result in an estimated loss savings of approximately 1.1%. Sherman Joyce, President of the American, and these sites are inside your materials as we go through them. Sherman Joyce, the President of the American Tort Reform Association, has confirmed, we didn't tell anybody that rates were going to go down if tort reform was enacted. Victor Shorts, General Counsel for the American Tort Reform Association, said many tort reform advocates do not contend that restricting litigation will lower insurance rates, and I've never said that in 30 years. Clips Webster, a Washington State Medical Association representative testifying in Washington, testified that caps were not going to lower premium costs, mostly due to the fact that economic damages and medical expenses are running at double-digit inflation. Insurance reform is the way to get at cost containment and reduction in premium costs. Oregon voters, you heard, have already rejected caps and limitations in this state twice. There's been a lot of discussion about physicians fleeing from the state. I have included a reference to the recent August 2004 Public Citizen report that was prepared showing that the number of active Oregon doctors have increased at the same rate from 2000 to 2004 as it did to 1995 and 1990, between 1995 and 1999. That Oregon data is consistent with evaluations that have been performed by the General Accounting Office concerning many of the AMA crisis states. Five studies were studied in depth by the federal government, and it was determined that many of the reported provider actions taken in response to malpractice pressures were not substantiated or did not widely affect access to health care. Some reports of physicians relocating to other states, retiring, or closing practices were not accurate or involved relatively few physicians. In the state of Pennsylvania, another AMA crisis state, the president of the Pennsylvania Medical Society was forced to admit that they had no data backing up the statements that the doctors were fleeing from the state en masse. In California, one of the states held up as the model for damage limitation and a model of tort reform that should be embraced by the nation, a California Medical Society study entitled "And Then There Were None, The Coming Physician Supply Problem," found that 56% of physicians in that state have experienced difficulty attracting physicians to join their practice. More than one-fourth of the physicians surveyed would no longer choose medicine as a career if starting over, and more than one-third of those who would still choose medicine would not choose to practice in the state of California. The problem of physician shortage, I think, was pointed out by one of the physicians testifying last week, that there is a shortage nationwide of physicians, and this has been documented, that there was a decrease in the amount of people attending medical school, and we're starting to see that come home to roost. Again, not a problem with the medical liability system, and not directly driven by torts, the tort system, as seen by states that have enacted tort reforms and still have difficulty recruiting physicians or have physicians wanting to practice in other states.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator.
Has there been any studies as far as that you could point us to where physicians have been interviewed as to why they have left the profession or why potential physician students have chosen not to enter the profession. You know, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that it's because of the trial lawyers it isn't any fun anymore, specifically.
Senator Winsett, Chair Pozanski, I'm again back in my office, may have a copy of this, and then there were none study of the California physicians. And there, the common denominator about a dissatisfaction had to do with the lack of reimbursement from the federal government, the lack of ability to generate income as a result of those cutbacks, the growing hassles and problems with managed care, paperwork, not being able to see patients and do what I think physicians would like to be doing aside from the business side of running an office practice. I don't have anything as far as a decrease of the number of students choosing to enroll in a med school education or track a med school to become doctors. I don't have anything like that.
Chair, I have to go here in a minute, but you know, I'm from a rural area, represent a rural area, and I have a number of physicians that I'm acquainted with, and I've interviewed a number of others. Without exception, their largest concern is the threat of lawsuits. Their largest concern is that being able to find adequate medical liability insurance. Some of them have recently been forced to leave practice because of the inability to buy it at any price. There is one particular community in eastern Oregon who all the doctors have essentially banded together in a brotherhood of if one of us goes, we'll all go together, and that's the only way that they can manage to continue to provide medical service to their community. The common denominator, the fear of being sued with no cap, and where they cannot survive, they cannot buy the level of liability insurance that will allow them to continue to practice safely to cover their potential losses. And it's not, of course, it isn't just their ability to practice, it's also everything that they own and everything that they've made for their entire lives. That's what the fear is. The fear isn't about paperwork. The fear isn't that it is from the people I've talked to. It certainly isn't about the paperwork. It isn't about the reimbursement. It is about being sued. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Senator Witsit, Chair Pozanski, I understand the constituents' concern that you've actually heard from, but I sort of hear two different concerns inside their comments to you, and that is, one, the inability to obtain available insurance at an affordable price as one concern, and then the other concern, the risk that their personal assets may be in jeopardy in some fashion as a result of a lawsuit. Some of the comments that I'm going to make about a professional liability fund, I think it would be directly of interest to your constituents as far as trying to find a solution to make insurance available and affordable for all practitioners in the state. As far as any type of concern about personal assets, I've been practicing not quite 20 years or so. I am not aware of a single case of any type where a physician's personal assets were ever placed at risk in any litigation, and the litigation has involved insurance companies and not individual physician assets. It's just my response.
If your liability insurance cap on your policy does not equal the amount of the award, you're telling us that the physician then would not be responsible for the additional award?
Senator Wiskett, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I am not aware of a single case where a judgment for damages...
That's not what I ask.
There is a legal responsibility, and then there's the reality of any of those personal assets ever being seized in an attempt to satisfy a judgment. And I think those are the differences.
So if I could just clarify, what I'm hearing is that legally there could be an attempt to go after the physician's personal assets, but in your study, your knowledge, that's never happened in the state in the 20 years that you've been involved.
That's correct, Chairman Krasinski.
Okay.
The next section in the written materials that you actually have shows the profits that have been seen inside of all the property and casualty carriers.
One second. Oh, sir. Senator Wissett, I know you need to leave. If you need to take off, you know, that's fine. We do have a doctor here who's going to give some testimony. I don't know how long it's going to take for his testimony. I thought Mr. Lane's, if you wanted to hear that. But if you need to leave now.
I do.
Okay, it will be on the record.
And yes, you can, okay. And it will bring it to you. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Lane, go ahead.
The section in the written materials documents for the committee's the profits seen in recent years, 2003, 2004, by property casualty carriers nationwide. The profits in the first quarter have caused restatement of earnings for CNA Financial Group, one of the carriers in this state, as a result of the profit surge as investment losses has declined. In Washington State, again, Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreider is reviewing a proposed 7.7 cut in medical malpractice premium rates by the physician insurance company up there to see whether that's enough in the face of record profits. I think it's high time that we take a look at what profits are being generated across the nation by insurance companies and see that that profit that is being gathered by them is returned to the individual policyholders. One of the observations that Senator Wittsitt made was a lack of availability and a cost of product. And the same thing was experienced by attorneys in the 70s. There was no insurers willing to, or very few insurers willing to insure attorneys for malpractice. And what insurance was available was astronomically priced and out of touch for most practitioners. Given that background, attorneys gathered together and came to the legislature and got a bill passed that established the Attorneys Professional Liability Fund. The fund began operations in July 1 of 1978 and have remained the mandatory provider of primary malpractice coverage for Oregon lawyers since that date. Beginning in 1991, the fund has offered optional excess coverage on an underwritten basis to Oregon lawyers up to limits of $10 million. Now, there's an example of an alternative funding mechanism that protects for negligence and provides defense in malpractice actions that has been available since 1978 and has made insurance available and kept it affordable for our attorneys practicing in the state. There's three components in the PLF for attorneys that I think we need to keep our eye on as we start talking about a professional liability fund modeled for physicians. And the three key components that I think the legislation must have in order to be successful, in order to see realized premium reduction to Oregon physicians. First, the PLF program for attorneys is mandatory for all attorneys practicing in Oregon. You must purchase from the PLF the minimum mandatory coverages. You can buy excess at your leisure, but you've got to have the minimum mandatory amount. Second, the mandatory minimum coverage is offered by a single insurance entity. And why that's important is all of the reasons that we talk about when we talk about investment cycles. Soft markets, hard markets. By allowing one single insuring entity to operate for all professionals, you eliminate that undercutting market in good financial times, and you don't see this rapidly expanding up and down, fluctuating rate change as a result of market conditions. The third and most important portion of the PLF for attorneys is that all attorneys are charged the same amount, regardless of practice area, regardless of risk. A domestic relations attorney is paying the same amount of money as one of the attorneys that were recently involved in the capital consultants lawsuits. Everybody pays exactly the same, and the risk is shared across the practicing lawyer community. Roseburg pays the same as Portland. And that's an important feature that initially caused concern when the PLF was first introduced. But over time has proven that spreading the risk evenly across the board maintains stable rates, makes it affordable for all practitioners, protects all members of the public. You heard a little bit the other day, and I just briefly want to touch on so-called transactional costs. And there was some comparisons to medical malpractice ought to be like workers' comp. Well, the workers' comp system, as you all know, is a system based upon payment of compensation without showing a fault. A worker is injured on the job. He files an 801. It's no determination. If it's a compensable injury, he's paid his medical expenses, his time off, and any associated permanent disability. By a strict statutory mechanism outlining degrees of loss, and it covers everybody. Right now, medical malpractice claims I would characterize as being the opposite end of that spectrum, where you have significant time and effort associated with investigation of facts, retention of experts, review of materials, discovery, all designed to get at whether there really has been an individual responsible for causing harm, and that harm was caused by a breach of the professional standard of care. That's a long way from absolute liability for a compensable injury in a workers' comp situation, and it's not a surprise when you understand the dynamics between those two ends of the spectrum that there's a higher transactional cost associated with prosecuting medical malpractice claims. Now, the bill in front of you, Senate Bill 446, we have offered the Dash 8 amendments, and I'm going to start the discussion there and return to the Dash 1 through 7s in a moment. If the committee is inclined to pursue some sort of a professional liability fund model for physicians practicing in the state, our amendments to 446 would include provisions in Section 1 stating that the premium charged to one physician may not be more than three times the premium charged to any other physician, thereby eliminating the significant wide range of classifications that are presently employed, where one physician may be paying 10, 20, 30 times the amount of another physician. In estimating the premiums under Section 1, the board may consider actuarial factors that are considered and also take into consideration other factors such as geographic location or practice types. Section 2 creates a medical insurance board and directs that the medical insurance board would establish a professional liability fund for liability claims. This would be the single separate insuring entity that would provide initial minimum coverage of some amount for all physicians practicing in the state. The Dash 8 amendments, as far as the PLF is concerned, have the three components that I've mentioned: mandatory, premium assessed equally or approximately equal, and payments collected and paid by a single insurance fund. Doing some rough math based upon the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services fact sheet that I believe has been previously distributed to the committee, CNA, one of the major carriers, CNA's earned premium over a five-year period has been approximately $81.6 million. And if that amount was broken down by year across the board of all of the insured physicians CNA protects, then the average cost of a premium in a given year would be $7,200. Turning to Northwest Physicians Mutual, $79.4 million earned over approximately 5 years. Per year average, per physician, approximately $7,800. The rate classification that is permitted to go on now in this state results in some physicians in certain risk classes being charged 10 times that amount. And it seems like the compression of the rates is a critical component and needs to be addressed in any professional liability fund. Turning to the rest of, or the majority of the Dash 8 amendments, we address pre-screening panels. pre-screening panels have been discussed in
Lane.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Before we go to there,
yeah.
Since I'm committee one, plus good counsel and our assistant and the assistant,
on our last day.
on our last, I think I'm going to take the liberty to ask some questions as we go through instead of waiting for. So one of the other, I know, dash amendments that are before us would, instead of having, let's say, the primary PLF model of where you would have the fund and the coverage for the primary coverage, is actually using the excess fund portion that would be mandatory. Can you do, maybe you're going to cover this in your presentation. If you are, I want to do some comparisons as to why you think that would or would not work. To me, it's, I want to have something on the record as to the different interest groups as to why they think it would work or not work for those reasons. So if you can just make sure that's within your presentation.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I'll jump ahead a little bit and take the PLF portion in the other bills right now and return to the pre-screening and try to answer your questions.
And it'd be a little bit more systematic for us.
Jumping through to the Dash 3 amendments, this particular proposal has a PLF component, it has a PLF component, but it does not include any rate compression, which is one of the problems, and it allows the commercial carriers to continue to insure physicians up to a minimum amount. I believe in the Dash 3 it is a $500,000 minimum mandatory. And then there would be some form of a PLF above the minimum mandatory $500,000. The problem with that proposal is it's sort of upside down. You're allowing the primary commercial carriers to continue to compete for market share up to the minimum mandatory $500,000 amount. So all of the routine business practices that we have observed causing the cyclic nature of premium rise and fall would continue to be in place under the Dash 3 amendments. There could be undercutting in the marketplace. If there's a desire for capitalization or attempts to secure larger market share for investment purposes, you can continue this practice of undercutting to secure that. At the same time, when you end that investment cycle and you start hardening, every one of those carriers that are holding physicians locked into the minimum mandatory amount could raise the costs up to that. So again, you're maintaining the system of detrimental cycles that we're seeing right now under the Dash 3 proposal. Moreover, because you've got the commercial carriers competing on the individual physician's insurance for the first minimum mandatory, and then a single entity above, you're going to end up with a conflict situation on any claim that may involve both the underlying commercial carrier's $500,000 liability and the excess that may be coming into play. It's going to make things a little bit more complicated. There's going to be a lot more transactional cost associated with that. It's going to be duplication of efforts that could be maintained more appropriately by one carrier that would be in charge of the $1 displacement up to what I believe the Dash 8 in ours had a minimum mandatory of $1 million. Finally, the Dash 3 amendment, by allowing the commercial carriers to remain in the marketplace for the $1 through $500,000 minimum mandatory, that's the lion's share of the purchasing cost. You know from your own experience, and people know from their own experiences, getting a policy for your car for $300,000 is a significant expenditure. Buying a $1 million umbrella on top of that is relatively inexpensive, comparatively. So the commercial carriers are able to maximize the dollars out of there. Their risk is capped at $500,000, so they have no real incentive for cost containment as well. So the one single insuring entity having responsibility from $1 to whatever the minimum mandatory is the critical component that needs to be in any type of legislation. That's the Dash 3s. I'm going to jump over to the Dash 6 as long as we're here. And the Dash 6 also creates a medical excess liability fund. That's in section, I believe, 7 of the dash 6, the 7-1A. That excess fund would provide plan participants coverage in the amount of $2 million to one or more claimants for all health care claims against a plan participant arising out of a single occurrence. $500 minimum mandatory obtained in the commercial marketplace with business as usual. A medical excess of 1.5 above that liability is capped at $2 million. And I do mean capped, hard capped, because sections 8.1 and 8.2 state the liability of the medical excess liability plan and or a plan participant as described is exclusive and in lieu of all other liability for a health care claim, including any liability for claim of contribution or indemnity by third parties. A claimant's right to pursue a health care claim against the plan and a plan participant under this act is in lieu of any other remedy that might otherwise have been available to the claimant. That's a hard cap for all damages, non-economic, economic, regardless of wage loss, regardless of wage, medical expense, regardless of harm to the individual. It's not only facially unconstitutional as declared as Lakin versus Cinco Products, directly contradicts the will of the people most recently when they were faced with the choice to impose a cap on just non-economic damages of $500,000. That's what's wrong with dash 3 and dash 6 in comparison to dash 8. And I believe those are the only other versions that are under consideration. I saw a reference in Senator Bates' work group update of May 18th that the dash 1 amendment was a working conceptual piece that was not under consideration. If at some time it becomes under consideration, then we could talk about the dash 1s if they are under consideration. But according to that work group update, that was a working concept piece that was not going to be under consideration. Turning to the pre-screening, and I'll do the same thing with the dashes as we go through here.
That'd be great.
Referring to the dash 8, which is a pre-screening that we throw up for the committee's consideration, and what we have done is tried to strike a balance between the legitimate claims in the system and not getting those bogged down or having people with legitimate claims faced with increased or double costs, expenses, and delay, and allowing the doctors to be satisfied that, quote, frivolous claims are not being asserted against them. And what we've done in our proposed pre-screening process is adopt some of the other legislation that's been around in 2000 and 2005 concerning the medical liability certification. And the medical liability certification would require a person intending to pursue a medical liability claim to file a certificate prior to commencing the action. And the certificate would include a description of the injury, the damages, it would describe the people responsible, and then it would certify that the claimant has conferred with a qualified expert who is prepared to testify that the identified health care provider failed to meet the applicable standard of professional care. And that's in Section 6. The board, or whoever the committee decided should receive that certificate, would then forward that certificate to the identified health care provider. And under Section 6A, upon receipt of the certificate, the physician would be able to see that another one of his colleagues is prepared to testify that there has been a breach of the standard of care. The physician, on receiving the certificate, would be required to file a written election. And that written election would say, I understand, I allow this case to proceed because it obviously has merits according to the certificate filed. Alternatively, the identified healthcare physician can request a hearing, and that would involve moving forward with the proceedings, and I'll discuss those. But the first point of pause would be in the hands of the physician to decide whether he, aware of the certificate, aware of the facts or the circumstances, was prepared to allow the case go forward, and this would not be admissible. It's in another section. So there's no downside for saying, you're right, we ought to let this case go forward directly into court. Or he could request, or she could request, the hearing. Now, if the hearing is requested, one of the most important pieces of information that we believe any pre-screening panel should have at its disposal is the institution or the provider's own investigation of the event at the time that it happened. Remember, by the time somebody actually proceeds to court, it may be a long period of time after an event has occurred. Moreover, the injured party may have been unconscious, may have no information at all regarding the case at issue. The physician, on the other hand, has what's called adverse incident investigation and peer review materials. Now, those materials, we believe, if the physician is requesting a hearing because he believes that that's a, quote, frivolous case, and it's going to go through all the machinations of a panel review in order to get into court, then the physician should be obligated to disclose those adverse incident investigation reports to the panel, but only to the panel for its review in order that it has all available information about the nature of the incident that the injured party is asserting a claim against. Section 7 describes the components of the panel if a panel is requested. It's the same basic makeup of panel members as we've seen in most of the other dash amendments. The conduct of the hearing is contained in Section 8. Changes that we note comparatively to some of the other variants are that the parties may be represented by counsel, and counsel is not prohibited from attending and participating in the proceeding. As Mr. Miller observed, the hearing has got to be open. Hiding the proceedings from the public, we don't think is in the best interest of anybody. Civil discovery and the issuance of subpoenas is limited to, I believe the choice of words was, extraordinary circumstances. And the participation in the hearing will not result in any privilege waiver, discovery of trial experts, or be admissible in any subsequent proceedings for certain constitutional ramifications. That's in Section 10. Section 11, 12, and 13 are similar to the fees, statute of limitations, tolling provisions, and stay of civil litigation if a case has been filed and a physician receives a certificate and elects to have it proceed through the panel system.
Let me ask a question.
Absolutely.
On the panel, if you're having one that was conducted and you're having the certificate filed and it gives that information that you said, would the panel be able to have that physician that has been certified, that would be the expert, come before the panel for questions that the panel may have?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, in Oregon presently, expert discovery is not permitted. Expert discovery is not allowed. The certificate itself would confirm that an expert has been conferred with, mm-hmm. and that the expert, in his opinion or her opinion, believes that the identified health care provider has failed to meet the standard of professional care. That should be enough to get into court. You would not open up the door to expert discovery, long been protected and honored in this state, and you're not going to get into a situation where costs and expenses are going to start to climb with calling in experts and having that sort of. So it would be the certificate would be the evidence presented as far as expert testimony that a breach of the standard of care has occurred.
Okay. And civil discovery, what would you anticipate would be permissible for the panel?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, there was discussion about whether there should be any at all or whether there should be full-blown. And on the on those two ends of the spectrum, there's a concern about minimizing the cost, getting the legitimate cases into court, so there shouldn't be full-blown discovery like there is in civil litigation. So That's where we started from. But they're prohibiting any discovery under any circumstance on any case we thought was perhaps a little bit too much. So the language chosen is an extraordinary circumstance. I would leave it to the discretion of the panel members to exercise their discretion about whether a case warrants a certain piece. The idea and the intent is to keep this to the bare minimum need. Medical records would all be available in advance. I don't have a specific in mind where civil discovery would be necessary.
Okay.
Comparing, then, as we've requested or you've indicated you desire, we move to the Dash 4 amendment, and that is one that has been briefly mentioned so far. The chair has indicated that if there's need for information, interested parties may be able to comment, but this is the main proposal. This is full-blown trial before you get to trial. This is depositions, discovery. This is $50,000, $100,000 worth of costs and expenses. This is 2 days hearings. This is full-blown litigation that will precede full-blown litigation. I have included some written materials that the committee members may wish to take a look at from Maine practicing attorneys, and those are in the back of the pocket packet. Interestingly, New Hampshire considered the Maine proposal in its 2004 legislative session, and the proposal failed. And these materials were submitted to the New Hampshire judiciary, who was considering the Maine proposal for adoption in New Hampshire. And I think they very well articulate the problems that real-life practitioners have felt in connection with the Maine proposals. I'll read one for the record that was written, and it's attached to your materials. The screening panel process has not improved the quality of health care in Maine. It has eliminated the rights of patients with non-catastrophic injuries caused by physicians and hospital malpractice to recover for their injuries. It has drastically increased the cost of pursuing malpractice claims. It has delayed the resolution of malpractice cases in a time when all civil matters come to the resolution much faster and much less expense. It's created an overwhelming sense of frustration and unfairness for patients injured by physicians and hospital negligence. It's done absolutely nothing to reduce the cost of health care insurance, or malpractice insurance, and has a very negative, serious impact on the willingness of a physician licensing board to discipline bad doctors. Some of the highlights of the comments are in the written materials. I'd refer those to you unless at some time the Dash 4s become of interest further to the committee.
Okay.
Closing, I think we have the Dash 5 and Dash 7 proposals. These offer no insurance reform proposals. They do not offer any type of pre-screening or alternative dispute resolution provisions at all. Both provisions in one form or another are limited to a cap, a one-sided cap on recoverable attorney's fees under a contingency fee agreement. They do not restrict the other side from spending whatever it would like to spend or hiring whatever attorney or expert it would like to hire. Both proposals are unfairly prejudicial to one side in the equation, do nothing, absolutely nothing, to reduce insurance premiums, nor could they if it's believed that the amount of the award is what's driving the premiums. Contingency fee is received from the actual award, so there's no correlations whatsoever, and nor would we expect to see any reduction if that's what the committee is trying to get after. So with those sort of lengthy comments, I'll stop there and take some questions from the committee if it has some after the other representatives might make some comments.
All right, Ms. Lang, thank you very much. Dr. Sidoris.
Chairman Krasanski and other distinguished members of the Commerce Committee, my name is Thomas Jefferson Sidoris, the second MD. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on behalf of my patients. My only qualifications to testify are that I've been in practice in Oregon since 1976 as an internist in the Portland area, and I'm a member of the Oregon Medical Association, the American Medical Association, all the major hospital medical staffs, and numerous professional organizations. I have been a spokesperson for the Oregonians for Insurance Reform, and I want to protect the constitutional rights of Oregonians, consumers, and medical patients. To that goal, I am in favor of a medical professional liability fund as a partial solution for medical malpractice insurance premiums. The real issue, in addition to medical malpractice premiums, is negligent malpractice and patient safety, as they are inextricably linked. The real solution for legislators, physicians, and attorneys is to work together to reach stable insurance rates for doctors in Oregon. Since both doctors and lawyers have a common concern for patients' well-being and improving patient safety, and together we can combine immense resources and expertise, this collaboration is crucial to our success in Oregon for improving the health and safety of all Oregonians. Oregon has been a leader in these efforts, and the history of Oregon's legal professional liability fund since 1978 represents an innovation worth considering. As this is one of the solutions already succeeding, there is no need to limit Oregon citizens, consumers, or patients' rights. Other solutions currently working include the Rural Insurance Relief Act, alternatives to medical malpractice lawsuits, mandatory alternative dispute resolution, and the Patient Safety Commission. I heartily applaud Senator Alan Bates and his working group to reach a compromise, including the Medical Professional Liability Fund. I have difficulty understanding why my professional organization, the Oregon Medical Association, is so resistant to this idea. The OMA has suggested that there are flaws to this approach, including the differences between medical and legal malpractice claims. While there may be some differences, which can be reconciled with some creativity, it is the spirit of innovation which seems to be lacking. Capitalization appears to be an obstacle, but if our legislature can find money to fund our increasingly expensive public education system, it should be able to help with the health care of our citizens. Physicians must be accountable for the costs, and for this, they must agree to reduce malpractice by better disciplining of doctors and improved transparency of health systems for patient safety. Escalating severity of claims is solved by reducing medical negligence. A complaint by the OMA CEO that an MPLF would not be equitable, meaning that low-risk specialists would be subsidizing the high-risk income specialists, suggests that the risk-sharing and accountability details have not been adequately explored or communicated. Has the rank and file of all physicians practicing in Oregon been consulted or surveyed? Although I'm not an accountant or an actuary, it seems to me that several mechanisms can even the financial burdens for all physicians, perhaps including a higher deductible for high-risk doctors, a surcharge for the underperforming negligent doctors, and also the rates could be changed based on a limited number of practice categories and their overall injury experience. Indeed, if a group of physicians or the OMA administrative staff say that the MPLF won't work, that appears to be a tacit admission that this medical community cannot profile its members, emphasize quality of outcomes, establish and adhere to a standard of care, and educate or remove its bad doctors. The fact that claims against doctors often involve other defendants, including hospitals and outpatient centers, is actually reassuring in that Oregon's citizens will benefit more by having all the parties accountable to a patient safety institution and insurance reform. I'm not sure that our MPLF needs to be patterned strictly after or upon the legal fund, or that it would be workable, but the concept and its execution is absolutely indispensable as a solution. With a slight modification, I would favor the idea of an enterprise liability system wherein the OMA, the legislature, and the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners collaborate in a tripartite association, perhaps with special funding, to reform our malpractice insurance industry. An analogy would be our constitutional form of government, with the OMA as the executive branch, the legislature with its funding and statutes as the representative assembly, and the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners as the judiciary with enforcement and review powers. Unpredictable malpractice insurance premiums, haphazard compensation for injured patients, rising numbers of the uninsured, and scandalous patient injuries in medical institutions point to the fundamental deficiencies in our state's healthcare system. This solution requires fundamental reform, meaning that patchwork policies not only won't work, but will further destabilize our already chaotic industry. New Mexico and Nebraska have medical professional liability funds. Other states, including Florida, have professional liability insurance companies created by their respective professional organizations. Why can't the OMA commit? Donald Pomisano, the past president of the American Medical Association, wrote, "Although the physician may aspire to give the best care, the law does not require the best." Our professional organizations should be promoting excellence in medicine, not what its members can get away with. I'm interested in your questions.
Thank you. Mr. Bocci, do you want to go ahead and give your testimony, or let me just ask. Senator Ringo, I know you came in through part of it. I've been asking questions since it's just been made. Do you want to take each person individually, or do you want to go ahead and hear the other person?
Well, I appreciate that, and frankly, I'm supposed to be in about 5 minutes back up at another meeting, so I won't be able to continue. I have a very important question, though, for Mr. Bocci. How's your foot doing?
It's better. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
I'm out of the booth.
Good, thank you. Mr. Chair, I just also want to thank Dr. Sedaris for his testimony. I think you're a champion for looking out for patients, and I appreciate that. And I would like to explore the concept of a medical liability fund in more detail than we've been able to do so far. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Ringo.
I have one other question since before Senator Ringo needs to leave. And at the end of your testimony, you speak of three states that appear to have some type of medical professional liability fund. Have you been able to do any research on that as to what the length that they've had them, what they provide for, or anything like that? And I'll open that up for any of the people on the panel.
I have read that information. I do not have it here, but I'm more than happy to provide it with you in an expedient fashion.
My trusted counsel will beat you to it.
Okay.
But thank you. Mr. Bocci.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, and the rest of the committee. I'm going to cut my comments very short, given everything that's been said, and try not to be repetitive. Just a couple of things. I'm here because I sat on the committee that Senator Ringo and Senator Bates put together, and I want to commend the doctors that were on it and the senators for an effort at reaching a true, honest-to-goodness solution to what is a problem. I'm kind of horrified that the plan that finally made it into print was what it was in terms of $500,000 in terms of coverage being made available to the general carriers. That does everything that you want to do for insurance an insurance bill to help the insurance industry, and absolutely nothing that is helpful to patients, to doctors, to anybody else. I'm not sure where it came from. I will say this. We made a vow at the beginning of this session that we would not quote each other out of that committee, and I'm not going to quote anybody there. I will tell you that the doctors that were there were very well-intentioned, as were the senators, and as were the three trial lawyers who went. We did not represent OTLA. We represented ourselves. I've sat across my desk with patients for 30 years. I want to bring just a little bit of reality to this hearing. Here's what I tell every single person who sits down with me with a medical negligence case. number one, and this is the reality out in the field, the doctors and hospitals win all the cases they should win. Number two, the doctors and hospitals win about 80 or 85% of the cases they should lose. The playing field is roughly slanted like this, and we're at the bottom. The realities are we have a trial by jury system in this country. Societal beliefs and false beliefs, right beliefs, it doesn't matter, get into the system. Access to doctors as experts is dramatically different. We're fighting for patient rights that, frankly, are so skewed right now that I estimate, and I'm embarrassed to say it, that I refer away as not having pursuable cases about 90% or more of the people I talk to. And of those people, in my heart, I know that more than half of them have pursuable meritorious claims. Meritorious claims. The reality is, the system is expensive, it's difficult, and we lose way too many of the cases we should win. We have to weigh what we take the client through and where the client ends up at the end of the day, and then make a recommendation that we believe is best for them. The fact that the focus of these hearings is to consider limiting patient rights at a time when they are at, if anything, an all-time low is astounding to me. My last few comments. What we came up with in that committee, in my judgment, was very close to what a model could be nationally to change this crisis, if it is indeed a crisis, throughout this country. I am not surprised that the insurance industry weighed in before that bill got written. I'm not surprised that they opposed this thing dramatically. I've got Mr. Dorgan's comments, and I can go through the differences he rates and all of this in detail if the committee wants it. But the truth is, this threatens them. And I think that the committee has to look very honestly at the incentive for any testimony before this committee and ask themselves why and how this is happening. I believe, very truthfully, that the malpractice insurance industry is threatened by that type of plan. And I also firmly believe that the one solution, the one easiest solution, other than reducing malpractice, is a physician's professional liability fund. It is interesting that we never see a bill from the OMA or the carriers or anybody else designed to reduce the incidence of medical negligence. That will require better communication between doctors' offices, hospitals, the ER and the OR, radiology and the OR. I spoke to several hundred doctors a couple years ago at a hearing for the medical Foundation for Medical Excellence. And what I told them, and I firmly believe, is that 80% upward of the cases I see where unnecessary harm results to patients result from communication breakdowns. There are ways to improve medical care dramatically that are not being explored, and instead we're playing nationally a political game that is designed to inhibit the rights of individuals in our society to get to the only place left for them to get an even playing field, and that's a courtroom. Just finally, a couple more comments. I said that before. A $2 million cap on all damages. I handle cases for catastrophically injured individuals. $2 million for somebody catastrophically injured but who can still have a quality of life, whose injury is not the result of their fault 1%, but demonstrably the fault of someone else. I see life care plans that can't be touched for $2 million. That is just the reality of medical care and life care in our world. And we're going to take those people and simply put them aside as not worthy in our society if we're left in a position where we're imposing that type of cap. The same thing happens with these attempts to limit contingent fees and put no limitations on the other side. If I need to spend $250,000 to process a medical negligence case, out-of-pocket money, complicated case, experts from around the country, out-of-pocket costs, not attorney fees. And I'm limited to a $100,000 fee maximum on the recovery. I've got to be a little bit crazier than I am to take that case. So what we do is we effectively legislate out of our entire system the opportunity for those among us who need it the worst, through no fault of their own, any chance at recovery or any quality of life. It bespeaks so much about our society that we consider it, that it's disheartening. The screening panels. I'll just comment on dash four for a second. The concept of making that admissible, A, you have tremendously increased the cost. And one more issue on cost. We don't have expert discovery. Every lawyer I know involved in our system on both sides of the wall knows that we handle our cases right now for about one-third of the cost of many other states because they have expert discovery. They travel the country. They depose every expert witness, every doctor. The costs are extraordinary. Well, making it admissible and in a court of law requires the plaintiff to go fully try their case, disclose their entire case to the other side, incur all of the costs, and then do the entire thing again. The insurance industry has lost all incentive to try and settle that case reasonably when they know they've got liability, because A, they know they can spend you into the ground that way, and two, until they go through the pre-screening panel and have a finding brought against them, they have no incentive. So every incentive that we should be giving the companies to act reasonably, we're taking away with that type of legislation. And for them to come, they may come in and say, well, we'll simply act reasonably and we always evaluate reasonably. And Mr. Chairman, it's just not reality. Reality is payments are made when they have to be made under an adversarial system. The Physicians Professional Liability Fund that was developed in that committee would do tremendous things to allow a monopoly company to legislate or to allocate preferential rates for doctors willing to handle OHP cases, Medicaid cases, Medicare cases, rural specialists. It takes care of a number of problems that exist in the system right now where those doctors are being underpaid and they don't have incentive, perhaps, to go to rural areas and practice. You can take care of that when the doctors control their own system. They could give preferential rates where the doctors as a whole divine a good for the people of the state of Oregon. If you take a $500,000 limit and make that and put that out to the general companies instead of having a monopoly, all of that incentive goes away. All of the good that would occur goes away. And all you do is you allow the insurance companies to benefit from taking most of the insurance dollars yet facing limited exposure. They'd never settle a case. So the practical reality is that just doesn't work that way. I appreciate your listening to my comments.
My pleasure.
To the extent that they're repetitive of others, I apologize.
I thank you for your comments. I appreciate it. It gives me clarity as to some things. I've got a couple of questions. Mr. Lane, I know you're here. You were here last Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken, or last Thursday, excuse me, at the last hearing.
Mr. Chairman, no. I was on the opposite coast, as a matter of fact, and was unable to be here.
Let me just... One of the issues that came up during the hearing was, I think Mr. Crude was giving the testimony and talked about the possibility of using a system similar to what Oregon has as a workers' comp system, and that would, in fact, be able to justify, I think, the dash 6, if I'm not mistaken. I want to make sure I got that right. Yeah. I believe it's a dash 6, but I guess the one thing is my understanding, I don't do workers' comp. My understanding is in that system, we basically take out one of the two components that you have to decide, and that's the fault. And so I wonder if you could give me some comments as to whether you would agree that a workers' comp style could work without having the no fault.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this workers' comp, as I recall in the back of my head, workers' comp medical now system was floated for the first time in a 2003 session in the House Judiciary Committee. There was a proponent there that said we could do this, and we could open up the doors so that we captured more injured folks and provided compensation to a greater number of folks. Well, Institute of Medicine, as you've heard before, 98,000 preventable deaths every year due to medical negligence. And other studies indicate that not one in 10 individual actually goes to see an attorney who may have been the victim of medical negligence. The workers' compensation system as presently designed is a no-fault system. Every employer pays into it, and every person injured who suffers a compensable injury is going to get paid for whatever injury suffered, whatever matter, without any type of fault. There's no question as to the fault. So comparing it with a medical malpractice system, you're opening, I guess in theory, if you're going to a Med-Mal workers' comp system, you're opening up the door to every single medical malpractice case. So the number of victims that you're going to try to compensate now out of this fund is going to grow exponentially compared to the number of cases that are brought on behalf of malpractice victims. First. Second, if you reduce, the only way that a injured malpractice victim is able to obtain compensation for his or her injuries right now is after showing that with expert testimony, which is required in every single case, that the healthcare provider failed to deliver the appropriate professional standard of care for that community. It requires a great deal of proof and consideration, jury instructions, evidentiary showing to establish both the liability, fault, causation, and damages. So you have a very complex system that you're going to eliminate for a no-fault system. You're going to have more people accessing the system, you're going to have greater dollar demands than you do in the workers' comp situation. I just don't see it fiscally sound. I don't think it's good public policy. I think you're going to get into the physician's worst nightmare that just poor outcomes are going to be compensated or being brought for compensation inside of the system rather than on a showing of a breach of the professional standard of care. So and also with the Dash 6, just so there's no misunderstanding, that workers' comp injuries are statutorily regulated and what, but there's a trade-off, a bargain, that they're getting their payments paid immediately. What the Dash 6 does is still retain the fault-based system, but now only caps the damages. So I don't see how it actually truly embraces a workers' comp no-fault model at all. I also remind the committee of some of the work that is going on now as a result of 2003 legislation. The Patient Safety Committee, with Dr. Sidoris reference, trying to get a handle on what is common medical errors inside the state of Oregon, trying to identify that and hopefully bring forward pieces of legislation or recommendations, at least, to minimize the number of medical errors that occur in Oregon. We also now have something that I think Oregon was a bit ahead of on the curve, because I'm hearing more and more states adopting the so-called apology legislation. There's a VA study that I think is the sort of the birth happened in West Virginia or VA hospital, where it found claims were reduced significantly with the mere ability to apologize for something. And I see a number of people that visit me that just want to find out what happened. They didn't get treated well by the system, and it's not a case, and you got to do a little hand-holding, and then you got to send them on their way. And I think that's a real beneficial step to reducing the number of claims that may be brought. And that's probably more than you wanted on the workers' comp.
Chairman Pozanski, may I make a quick comment?
You may.
I'm a practicing physician, and over the many years that I've been in practice, it's my impression that the current workers' compensation system is a disaster. I think it's a sham for medical fairness for the patients who are injured. Many times they are paid much less than what they deserve, or they can't receive payment at all. And their cases are often decided by experts who work for the insurance companies. Again, I think we need insurance reform in that area, too. Thank you.
Thank you. The other question I had, I have not had a chance to go through the Dash 8s in detail, but looking at some of the other models under the PLF style, there are exemptions for, like, government attorneys. I would assume that this model, where you've said that everyone would be a mandatory participant, wouldn't allow for those type of exemptions for, let's say, government doctors that are working within government facilities or not.
Chairman Pazansky, I would recommend to the committee that it either include those people if it's beneficial for the system overall, or exclude those people if people feel that it would not help the overall state situation. So I would leave that policy decision of including or excluding to the committee in how they wanted to draft the PLF model.
Okay. Council, any questions? Is there anything else y'all like to share? Thank you very much for your time and your patience with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bishop, I know you'd like to come up. I'm also going to ask those that are here today, is there anyone else who wanted to give public testimony today? Please signal, so I know that you'd like to give testimony. If not, Mr. Bishop will be our last witness. Bruce, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee staff. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I'm testifying somewhat reluctantly right now because I really only want to correct for the record an impression that may have been created for the committee. Previous witness indicated that there's never any attention to correcting errors that occur. Mr. Lane, I think, addressed that subject somewhat more cordially than I would have probably, but I think there is a repeated record in Oregon of both the legislature and medical providers stepping up and squarely facing that issue. And the intimation that somehow that's being ignored, I think, is improper in testimony. We all get excited when we testify sometimes and are making things up as we go along, but that's just dead flat wrong.
Ms. Bishop, I appreciate your coming forward and saying that on the record. I do know that we've had other testimony that has actually given that, and I did not have the impression that there's not been any policies or programs. I understand from Mr. Gallant's testimony previously, as well as others, that AMA has programs, and I believe some of the insurers as well have different programs that they have available and actually utilize within the profession.
I'm glad that you're aware of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And if there's not anyone else, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 446. And, Council, is there anything else we need to do?
See you Thursday.
And just for the for those who are here in attendance, our next meeting is scheduled for next Thursday. It's the intent of the chair to take care of whatever bill that will be moving forward on Senate Bill 446. As well as the other bills, we've got 968, and I'm not sure if there's anything else that's in the committee that we need to be working on or not. If it is, we'll have it posted, and we'll post those probably tomorrow, and then if we need to do any additional posting, it will be done on Tuesday, so we'll make the 48-hour rule. So with that, Karen, again, thank you very much for being part of our team. And hopefully we'll be able to get all of us together in at a time where we can actually break some bread together and have some fun. So with that, we'll close the committee for today.